My name is Dario Hasenstab. I'm here with Balder Hagrids, and the Western Bubble has been added to a group chat, and we don't really know what to do at the moment. Today we're talking about the obvious thing, right? The topic that has been keeping everyone maybe on their toes for the last week or so. It is that the U.S. government, or parts of the U.S. government, planned a little trip to Yemen, where they happened to drop some bombs on civilians via a Signal group chat. Balder, why are we speaking about this topic today? Because it shouldn't we just brush it off as some of the most stupid thing that has happened in U.S. history?
Well, that is the first step, Dario. Good to be here again. Yes, the first step is just to say, wow, this was really, really stupid. But then once you start analyzing it, there's actually a lot to unpack here. And there's a lot of contents that we can discuss about the way they speak about certain actors, but also just the observation that this is such a new bit of evidence showing how they completely disregard basic good governance, basic institutional respect for traditions. You do not make foreign policy on a group chat. That's not how it's done. And it just shows where the Trump administration is at the moment. And there, I think there's plenty to talk about beyond the obvious, namely that, wow, someone was really, really stupid.
Well, let's quickly recap for the listeners who maybe have been living under a rock for the last week. The Atlantic, right? One of the magazines, newspapers that I'm subscribed to, and I'm a big fan of it, right? The editor-in-chief of The Atlantic published a piece about a few days ago where he basically said, I was added to a group chat between the Vice President of the United States, the Director of the CIA, Director of National Security or National Intelligence, the National Security Advisor was in there. A group of really important people, unfortunately, really important people. And for some reason, Jeffrey Goldberg got added to this as well. And he remained quiet all throughout the conversation. And this is the first question I actually have for you, Balder. Let's say you had been added to this group chat. Would you have stayed quiet or would you have left the group chat? Because Goldberg details these thoughts at the beginning of his article. He generally thought, should I leave? Should I not? Because I might be reading things that are closely related to national security, and it's better not in the public eyes.
This is a fascinating question. I understand as well that some of his doubts were in the beginning, is this real or is this some kind of setup? Are they trying to, you know, hoax me? Is this some, you know, there are these organizations that try to expose journalists, you know, so they were hoping that he would say something stupid in chat and then they would, then this organization could say, look, The Atlantic, they're a bunch of clowns. He wasn't sure if it was real. He was only sure the moment the bombs actually dropped in Yemen, when in the group chat he saw at 1:45 or whatever the time was, we are going to do this. And then he looked at CNN and he actually saw that that's exactly what happened. So I would certainly, until that moment of confirmation, stay there kind of fascinated by, is this real, isn't this real? And if this is real, how can this happen? Now, the interesting conversation is what you do next. So he decided to then leave and basically write the article he wrote and eventually publish all the screenshots that he had made. There is an argument, and a lot of people made that, that he could have also stayed in and basically waited for a whole year and written the most explosive book ever written about the inside dealings within the government. But of course, there is the problem of legality, right? There's the issue of, hey, he is now exposed to classified information. He knew what he was doing. So I probably would have done the same as he did. Basically, wait until you have confirmation that it's real. At that moment, you start treading scary legal ground because you shouldn't be in there. You shouldn't have this. You don't have clearance. You're reading classified materials, and at that moment you leave, and nobody can blame you for anything. It wasn't your fault. So I probably would have done exactly what he did.
Well, because I think there's also a moral problem with staying in there for a year. It's there are some real risks that Right Signals is one of the safer messaging channels out there, but it's by far not the safest you can do, particularly not if you're part of the United States government, where you have the Situation Room or these the way I understand, like these boxes in different ministries and houses where you can go in for secure communication, but you're told to leave out your phone, actually, right? So this is by far not the safest form of communication. And I think it was his, to speak with the words of an American, it was his patriotic citizen duty to actually make this public, to ensure that hopefully from now on this will not happen on just random chats anymore, because it is a national security problem, right? So kind of, so in a sense, luckily this only happened on Yemen, and they are ideally closing all the "what are we going to do about Russia" group chats now, because those might be some more serious conversation, like, well, some more serious kind of intelligence failures then.
Yeah, that's an argument that many people find powerful. I personally don't really have much patience for patriotism and nationalism and all that. The question is more, do you
civic duty?
Civic duty. I don't. No, I mean, be a good person, be nice to your neighbors. But this idea of the United States versus everyone else, or in my case, the Netherlands versus everyone else, is a bit silly. There might be a case that you want to make sure that your phone or your technology doesn't get then hacked, and that allows them to go in there, just from a perspective of, again, not being responsible for unforeseen consequences, just in general, right? I mean, what if, for example, they said something about, hey, let's meet in that restaurant tomorrow, and then some terrorist organization plants a bomb there. All of a sudden, you're part of that kind of violence. That is something that I could understand. The whole patriotism thing, no, I think it's much more, if you go down that route, it's much more moral and patriotic to be exposing the powers that be. That is what you as a journalist should do. You're not there to defend the Pentagon. You're not there to defend violence in Yemen. You're there to hold your government to account. And what is the best way to do that? Well, that's up for debate, but I know that I'm in the minority here. I've never understood nationalism in the way that most people understand it. It's not something that I've ever been able to connect to.
Well, and to add here, right, he didn't initially publish the majority of the texts, right? The ones that they felt were sensitive, they didn't publish. But then, in the days following this, the publication of this article, the Trump administration, instead of just acknowledging that, hey, this was a mistake, we should probably fire someone, right, some symbolic, right, what US politics would usually do, right? Oh, let's fire someone, they were responsible, some low-level worker within the government, he created the chat for us, right? That's kind of the story that's being spun now. But instead of doing that, they immediately went after Goldberg, after The Atlantic, calling it a hoax, an idiot, right, a loser, a lowlife, and really basically tried to discredit him, forcing him to ultimately publish the whole chat after asking the government, hey, is there anything classified in it that I shouldn't be publishing? They said, no, but we would rather not. And then he kind of tried to just credit himself again, right, to make sure that, hey, I wasn't lying. He then published the entire screenshots, which we now have in front of us.
Yeah, so it was those two different things, right? The ad hominem attacks were brutal and also very much exposing the kind of attitudes that these people have at the moment. Like, I mean, they've never been a big fan of him in the first place, right? Goldberg has not been on the list of favorite people by the Trump administration. But the ad hominem attacks that occurred immediately were just some kind of weird, completely obvious attempts to distract from what matters, because it didn't matter what kind of person this was. It doesn't matter whether Goldberg is the nicest and the most sophisticated journalist in the world or is a lowlife. He was in on a chat that he shouldn't have been in, and he published that. So that was very interesting to observe, the aggression with which they went after him immediately. The second bit is slightly more nuanced, in the sense that he also had some serious doubts about the legality of publishing it, right? He knew that this was classified. He knew that once you start talking about F-18s dropping missiles or bombs in Yemen, then that obviously goes well above anything that he is allowed to see. And he wanted to make sure that he didn't do anything illegal. Now, then you got the interesting situation that you got the hearings in which Tulsi Gabbard actually made the case like, no, nothing was classified. And that then opened the door for The Atlantic to say, okay, if nothing is classified, then we can start doing that. In order to then go to through due diligence, they did check with the departments. And the way I understand it is the only department, the only ministry that said, actually, be careful, it's actually not a ministry, but it's the CIA. They said, could you please redact the name of a certain person? Because it could put that person in danger. And that's what they did. And beyond that, basically, they got this open door by Gabbard and the others who just claimed that there was nothing classified in there, which again shows the incompetence of these people. It is astounding.
Well, which then immediately, though, that was kind of, right, this thing of, hey, we're going to redact that name. It was in the same Senate hearing, was then kind of refuted by John Ratcliffe, right, the director of the CIA, kind of saying, oh, but that was just my chief of staff, right? Kind of him himself giving away who it was. There was this question kind of thrown around, but how safe do you feel now as like an intelligence operative in the field, as soldiers, right, who are conducting those strikes? Because I didn't find that scenario very convincing. But yeah, let's say that some actor would have sent this information to the Houthis. Yeah, they could have prepared better and maybe done some damage to those American soldiers. So how do you feel if these are your bosses?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think this specific chain of messages would probably not, even if it had been made public, the only thing that probably could have happened is that the Houthis that were targeted could have said, okay, they're going to strike there at 1:45, I'll make sure to be somewhere else. You know, that kind of thing. I don't think that there was much chance of it actually directly hurting U.S. soldiers, U.S. pilots, anything like that. The Houthis don't have sufficient technology. They have more sophisticated weaponry than most people think, but not sufficient enough to stop an F-18. However, it's the principle, it's the problem that this is one example of how many other of such messages and chains and communication forms. And that is where your question is completely legitimate. If you are an operative, you now have a bunch of essentially incompetent policymakers who do not understand the importance of careful procedure, who do not understand the importance of institutional governance, that are now going to put your lives in danger. And by the way, immediately in the past couple of days, other things have come out about passwords floating around, and all, because now the media is on it and the media is paying attention to it. But it's completely predictable because the group of people that have been put around Trump, or Trump has selected around him, are simply not experts in their fields. They are not people who have shown a track record of knowing what they're doing. Hegseth, as Secretary of Defense, should never be anywhere near that position. He doesn't have any kind of curriculum that would suggest that he is capable of taking on such an important role. And yet here we are.
And this, right, so moving away now from the fact that there was a group chat, I mean, I think we can agree that wasn't the smartest thing to do. It's also just funny, right? It's funny to think that the idiots in the room, that everyone knows they're idiots, that they're actually doing such idiotic things. That to me is just entertaining. It has created some great jokes. I mean, the intro to this episode was, oh, we've been added to a group chat, right? I mean, that's the number one joke I've heard from everyone in the past week. Let's move beyond that and let's do what the Western bubble usually does. And
excuse me to interrupt you, Dario, but I understand that you're young and you can find fun. The fact that I called them idiots, I don't think there's anything funny about it. It scares me every day. I think it is such a scary world that we live in, right?
Well, that's the benefit of being part of Generation Z. We have seen, in our young lives, we've seen so many things go wrong already. What else is supposed to go wrong? Right? It's generally what I think is, quote unquote, wrong with this generation, is that we have been broken from the get-go. And there's not much that can kind of shake this generation. It's, I mean, what else are you going to throw at us, right? Pandemics, wars, economic crisis, and so on and so forth. I mean, that's probably a topic for a different day. But I think that's genuinely the reason why we humor this.
Yeah, and that generational disconnect is fascinating to observe. But it also is interesting to think about in terms of, your generation being the next group of policymakers in 20 years' time or so, what does this mean, right? I mean, you know, not that my generation is doing a great job, by the way, right? It's not as if my generation, no, it's my generation who has caused this world that you find yourselves in. But it does become a very scary place where people turn this into something like, ha, this is entertainment, rather than, hang on, we should be panicking, because too many people are not panicking about this, and as a result, there's not sufficient backlash against this.
To quote my sister-in-law, right, who is proper Generation Z, right, younger than me, I think her response would have been, it's hard to do a worse job than you, right? And in that sense...
Well... I would then use the meme of your generation, hold my beer, right? Let's see what how much worse it can get, actually.
Yeah. Is that a threat? Right. So now moving on to kind of like the meta like level conversation. I think the actually more interesting conversation coming out of this, and that's looking at the decision making process of these idiots. And what goes so right? Let's take a step back. These airstrikes on Yemen killed a bunch of people, right? These were airstrikes on an armed group basically, but surrounded by civilians, right? It even said so in one of the text messages, right? Yeah, we hit the guy we wanted to hit. He was in his girlfriend's house. Yeah, I'm sure the girlfriend didn't commit any crimes. No way I can know. But right, the fact that we're talking about a group of idiots making decisions to take out entire houses, drop bombs on them, very expensive bombs with the most advanced military in the world, basically dropping bombs on people, that's scary. That's really, really scary. Why are they having that type of conversation in a chat and not somewhere in the situation room surrounded by experts, consultants, right, that actually know and can guide them a little bit?
Yeah, and it's worse than that. It wasn't just a house where the girlfriend happened to be, who obviously should not be killed for anything. She has nothing to do with this. But it was a building with many more people in that building that had absolutely nothing to do with, you know, the way I understand it, it was an apartment building. And so if you then kill 20 people in order to get one person, then at a very, very minimum, and this is still being generous to them, you would expect a certain solemn approach to it. A certain like, okay, we had to do this. We had to take him out for whatever reason, but let's not be flippant about it. We just murdered an awful lot of people who are innocent. Instead, they put all those emojis in there and all that. Yeah, it's absolutely very unpleasant. Now, that procedural thing is so fundamental, right? You do not make policy, certainly not this kind of policy, which is about life and death, on a group chat. There are so many reasons why you need to have a serious conversation at an absolute minimum, seeing each other through screen on Zoom or whatever technology you use. But ideally, in a secure location, as you mentioned, a situation room where you've got experts who can pitch in, where you have you have these politicians and policymakers who make the final decision, but continuously get pulled back by people who actually know what they're talking about, where also you can look at each other's faces and you can get a sense of the vibe in the room. You get a sense that this is actually serious business and not some kind of computer game. I cannot understand how in today's world people think that it's a good idea to have these conversations on chat. It's just insanity to me. And it's you know, I'm not that old yet, I'm 47. It is a world where I'm disconnected from that reality that these people live in. Who thinks this is a good idea? It's outrageous.
And then even scarier is the actual focus of the conversation. Right, so the group chat kind of starts with, "Hey, we're planning on doing this. Please name your contact people," and so on and so forth. And then there's this note of, "Hey, we're going to do this now," but the conversation is exactly not about that, right? It's not about should we do it or should we not do it. It's more about when should we do it, right? And the most kind of the scariest message here is by the biggest idiot in the room, I'm going to claim, by J.D. Vance, right? Who he starts out hopeful, at least to me. He's like, team, I'm out for the day doing an economic event in Michigan, but I think we're making a mistake. And you would think that that's the beginning to basically him saying, ah, should we really, right? There's a lot of civilians in the area. Is it really worth taking that guy out? And so on and so forth. But no, he thinks we're making a mistake with regards to the timing of this, because, and then I continue here with his message, 3% of U.S. trade runs through the Suez Canal, right? The Canal of Egypt, the one that the Houthis are blocking, why the United States is upset with the Houthis. 40% of European trade does. There's a real risk that the public doesn't understand this or why it's necessary. Right? And then kind of he says a bit more at the end. But that's shocking that the conversation is not about should we do this or not, but it's more about, oh, I don't think we should do this right now because those pesky Europeans, they don't deserve our help. Right? And then also throwing in a wrong number, or like a number that doesn't really grasp the entire situation about U.S. trade and how trade is interconnected globally.
Yeah, so it is just fascinating that that is their concern, and it shows something about their obsession with Europe and their transactional obsession, which, by the way, comes from their boss, right? Trump sees himself as the transactional president, and the idea of global stability or global leadership or diplomacy is something that's alien to them. It's just, hey, we do something, what do we get in return? That's their idea. But then, exactly as you're saying, there is this enormous gap in understanding when it comes to how the world operates. So even if that statistic was true, and it isn't, we'll talk about that in a second, global economic stability is absolutely in US self-interest, right? Just like it's in China's interest, in Europe's interest, the United States doesn't want a crisis in the Red Sea, in the Gulf, in any of the major trading areas in the Suez Canal, because that would actually disrupt way more than just the goods that go to the United States, right? It's much more than that. It would have serious repercussions on energy prices, on financial markets, and anyone with a little bit of understanding of how the world works would get that. Now, on top of that, that percentage, 3% goes to the United States from the Suez Canal, is only true in the literal sense that ships don't stop. They go immediately across the Atlantic after that, Mediterranean, Atlantic. But a lot of the trade that actually reaches Europe eventually does end up in the United States, but either gets processed in Europe or just administratively registered, or there's something else that happens before it goes on through the Atlantic. So statistically, it's completely wrong. But more importantly, from a broad understanding of global affairs, it shows this incredible lack of knowledge on the side of these very important people. And that is where, in a normal traditional situation, you at the very minimum would have an expert in the situation room who is there not as a policymaker, but just to provide understanding, information, knowledge, who raises their hand and says, hang on, hold on, there's a problem here because this is not quite correct. That's why you do it in that kind of setting and not like a bunch of frat boys on a group chat.
And the original reason to do this, all right, the strongest reason to do this, as J.D. Vance called it, is because POTUS said to send a message.
Yeah.
But whatever, I'm sorry, but why are we sending a message killing people?
No. It doesn't make any sense. Look, we can, maybe at some other points, we need to have a conversation about the whole strategy towards Yemen and the Houthis, right? I mean, and the consequence, because none of this makes sense. But what the message is, nobody really knows. The message towards the Houthis that the United States doesn't like it? What? Message towards China? What kind of message? Well, what is this? What are we trying to communicate here? Nobody knows. And I think that's kind of a first condition for good messaging, that people understand what you're trying to tell them, right? The other thing that is so clear in the quote that you gave, and there are many more quotes like that, is how obsessed these people are with Europe. Now, I say that as someone who likes Europe, I live in Europe, I appreciate Europe, I think that Europe does a lot of silly things and makes a lot of mistakes, and there's a lot of bad policy making in Europe, but as a continent, I think it's okay. But regardless, they are absolutely obsessed. They hate the idea of Europe free riding, as they say it, off the backs of American efforts. They somehow believe that Europe has been leeching off American power and that the Transatlantic Alliance has had no benefits for the United States whatsoever, that it's just the United States bailing Europe out over and over again. And as a result, they are set on cutting those ties. And it's clear over and over again in these messages. And of course, that is fascinating to observe. And I think really good for European leaders to see with their own eyes.
Just to kind of back that up with some of the original messages, right? So after a quick discussion on, oh, what's the timing of this and will this, right, will this send a good enough message? It very quickly develops into this direction of, we have to bail out Europe again. Right? And that's exactly what J.D. Vance says, right? I just hate bailing Europe out again. And then Hegseth actually responds to this directly and says, I fully share your loathing of European freeloading. It's all caps pathetic. I kind of saw the European media reaction to this, that Europe said, oh, whoever hasn't received the message yet, this is the message. I mean, you have a bit more experience, right, in this field. I assume the European leaders really got that message, right? Because I only have the media echo.
Yeah, so it's absolutely something that was already clear before this, right? I mean, if 2025 has shown anything, and we've discussed this before, is that the current administration has very little patience for Europe. That's obvious. Now, where this has been this week particularly interesting in European dynamics is not from, for example, a French perspective, in the sense that the French kind of are jumping at the opportunity here to point this out and to say, hey, look at how much they hate us. Other countries, please gather around the French campfire and we will start talking about the future together. You don't have to go back to the United States. But most importantly, it has an impact on the countries such as the Netherlands, who are still resisting, and also the UK to a certain extent. The Netherlands still resisting this switch away from the transatlantic alliance towards Europe. They can't deal with it because their mindset has been so transatlantic. And they cannot avoid reality anymore reading those messages. And the French are basically throwing this in their face, right? In the Dutch face. Like, look at this. What are you talking about that we can still mend fences? What do you mean that we can still sort of restore a relationship? Look at how they're talking about us. You are also European. This is about you, not just about us. And so in that sense, it is very, very useful for, if you like, this new European project to pull the ones that are hesitating over the line to say, look, you cannot hide behind some kind of 20th century idealism anymore. It doesn't exist. It's dead. Move on, please. Go with us. And that's exactly what these past couple of days has been. That's what has been occurring in capitals.
The morality of this conversation is, right, so aside from everything we've just said about the relationship between Europe and the United States, what really shocked me beyond that is obviously the morality, right? We already spoke about this with regards to the conversation focusing on the messaging and Europe instead of the lives lost in Yemen. And this complete disregard of any morality, we have seen so just too many times over the past few weeks, right? And the example that actually last week I thought, oh, this will be the topic of today's episode, is that airplane with migrants for Venezuela but kind of being sent from the United States to El Salvador, to those infamous prisons there. Then a court ruling against that, saying that, hey, this plane that is in the air has to turn around and go back. There wasn't, like, you didn't follow due process. But then the Trump administration just saying, no, we'll make a statement out of this, we'll send them there anyways, and we will disregard the courts, right? So on the one hand, you have a terrible just message on to migrants and on migration, absolutely despicable. And the second thing is, you've just blatantly, right, separation of powers, that thing that everyone always loved so much about the United States and how they enshrined it in their constitution, you just disregarded that.
Yeah, so that latter point goes back to the conversation we had before, the complete absence of any respect for institutional traditions, good governance, completely not understanding why certain things are as they are and why you should, if you love the United States, going back to patriotism, which I don't understand, if you are a patriot, why you should absolutely listen to courts, because it's important for the well-being of your country. And sometimes that means that you lose certain political battles, but in the long term, you strengthen your country by respecting that. That understanding is completely gone. And that first bit is something that has to do with basic humanity, right? So I have absolutely no intellectual patience for people who believe that this kind of violence is productive, that this kind of violence that they're engaging in is actually helpful to anyone. It is not helpful. It doesn't work. But morally speaking, rather than intellectually, at a very minimum, I would expect that people who do make the case that dropping bombs on foreign countries that start wars in Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere, that send immigrants in this kind of way to Venezuela or elsewhere, that at a very minimum, they understand that they're talking about real human lives and that they do so with a certain level of respect. That you do so with a certain level of understanding that this is not some kind of Hollywood film, this is not some kind of video game. You are actually causing a lot of grief and harm. Now, if you want to make the case that that is necessary to protect your country or it's necessary for the greater good, make your case. I think you're going to be wrong, but make the case. But at a very minimum, basic level, please recognize that you're talking about human beings. And that is something that is completely absent once again over here. In the way they talk about immigrants, of course, they believe that immigrants are some kind of horde of insects that just need to be eliminated, destroyed. And in the case of Yemen, they talk about it as if all of them are just evil terrorists and there is not any person that doesn't deserve to die. And they don't care about who gets hit. They don't care about what gets destroyed. And that to me is, yeah, it makes me deeply, deeply concerned about the world that we're heading into. You know, that this kind of conversation can happen between these people and that they seem okay with all of this.
And it almost seems like a badge of honor they are receiving, right? I mean, particularly on the migration side of things, right? Where, we really showed kind of the courts and the deep state that, hey, we're sending those back. But also on, right, in their constant fight against Europe, because on top of the kind of really terrible news coming out about the treatment of migrants, typically from Latin and South American countries, you also now have like bits and pieces coming out about just your normal, like everyday European who's just going there for vacation with proper documentation, also being detained for weeks and then kind of being sent back and deported. Sometimes after, right, their phone was searched, as happened to this French scientist, right, after their phone was searched by the border control saying, oh, you criticized Trump? No, we don't want you here anymore. We will deport you back, right? And that, instead of kind of taking that and saying, oh, no, we really went over the top here with our anti-migrant rhetoric. No, for them, it's a badge of honor.
Yeah, and it sometimes makes me laugh a little bit in the sense that I just imagine immigrants from, let's say, Latin America reading those stories about a French scientist being detained or some Germans being locked up. And looking at that, say, yeah, welcome to our world, right? I mean, Europeans are just outraged that this happens to them, but this has been happening for decades now, not just under the Trump administration, towards other types of immigrants or people just trying to travel into the United States. So in some ways, it's like Europeans being made aware of a reality that has existed for much longer for the others. But yeah, it again shows that kind of disregard for the complexity of the world, not understanding that this is going to hurt the United States in the long run, because there's already signs that U.S. Tourism industry is suffering tremendously. Flights from Canada have, I think, gone down by something like 70%. It was a ridiculously large amount in terms of passengers wanting to travel into the United States. The Netherlands, Germany, and others are issuing travel warnings. I mean, how ridiculous is this getting? That Europeans are warned by the governments, don't travel to the United States because you're going to be unsafe, because the authorities are not to be trusted. They're not going to respect your rights. I mean, obviously, if you look at the bigger, longer-term picture, this is deeply, deeply destructive for the United States. You're not going to have scientific conferences in the United States anymore. I mean, why would you ever organize it there if half of your scientists are going to be arrested? You're not going to have people wanting to work in American firms. I hear quite a lot for the past 2 months that a lot of my colleagues are actually not interested in projects in the United States because they don't trust that they're going to be safe. This is insane from a US perspective. And it just shows once again the complete lack of either ignorance about what they're doing to their own country, or it is basically not caring about how they're hurting their own country and just fulfilling some kind of political fetish that they have, knowing that they're hurting the United States, but they don't care about it.
I mean, with scientists, there's this extra level of just hating science, hating facts. I mean, just before the recording of this episode, right, I saw this article that there's three professors from Yale who are now moving to Toronto University, right? So you have this this opposite brain drain now happening. And you know me, and the listeners know me, I always have to bring up football at some point. Speaking of the World Cup 2026, which will be held in the United States, Mexico, and Canada, what do you do with all the fans who want to go and visit the games, right? Particularly, right, because there's always your South American teams. But just a few days ago, Iran actually qualified for the World Cup. How are they going to play games? How are their fans going to come and visit? And this might be, right, this might be like another nail in the coffin, ultimately, because for Trump, this is obviously a big project of prestige, right, where he gets to be there and the whole world has to watch him. Yeah, but what if no one is in the stadium because you didn't let anyone in?
No, and what is just as important here is not just the current policies from 2025 and the Trump administration, but this is a process that has essentially been going on since 2001, right? That you've got a culture inside border guards. Everyone who's traveled to the United States, myself included, will know how incredibly unpleasant security can be when you get into the United States, when you land and you have to go through border security, how deeply antagonistic they are, and how you definitely do not feel welcome as an outsider. This is a process that is not just down to Trump. Like, most of these things are dynamics that have existed for a long time. It's just that Trump does it so aggressively and so blatantly, and it makes it so obvious. But even without Trump, this is a process of many, many years. Scientific conferences have been going on the decline in the United States ever since 9/11. There's this wonderful story, it's horrifying, but wonderful story of a plane being turned around because a woman saw someone else scribbling some code on a piece of paper, and he looked a little bit Arabi, Muslimy, whatever, because he had a dark beard and dark hair. And it turned out to be an Italian mathematician who was just preparing for a conference in the United States. And the whole plane turned around based on that. So you have a country that has already been sliding down this hill. And now, because of the Trump administration, they're basically accelerating into the ravine. And the consequences are going to be dramatic for the United States. It's going to be shown in statistics in 10, 20 years' time how the country will have suffered because of this.
At the end of this episode, I do want to circle back to the Signal chat, because one point we haven't mentioned yet is one of the reasons why Signal is considered to be safer than other options is because there is there's the function that your messages get deleted after like a week or 4 weeks. That's a whole, well, I mean, it's lovely for you planning your weekend getaway with your friends, right? It I don't think it matters. But it's highly problematic if you have US officials where everything basically has to be documented that they do. If they are on an app like this, I assume purposefully, and purposefully having the settings so that these messages disappear after 4 weeks. I mean, these messages would have never seen the light of day, never seen any archive if it hadn't been for that journalist, Jeffrey Goldberg.
Yeah, it is illegal. They have to keep that record. So if they delete those messages, they are breaking the law. Now, you just mentioned the flight that was ordered by a judge to return on its way to Venezuela, but to return because it had broken the law and they completely ignored it. We are now living in a world where they clearly don't care about those rules. They don't care about the law. They feel invulnerable from persecution, unlike the first Trump administration, when there were still strong institutions blocking the most egregious kind of steps by Trump and his surroundings, saying, no, you can't do this. There are rules in place, even for the president, even for the White House. Now those institutions have collapsed, they folded. And the Trump administration is just happily ignoring them, and there's no real pushback. The result of this is that there is a certain lawlessness now. And using Signal is just one example of that. But there are many, many examples of a White House and major policymakers of the United States breaking the law, ignoring judges, ignoring the departments responsible for ensuring good governance. And this is a situation where the founding fathers of the United States will be turning in their grave. The founding fathers spent a lot of time debating, their time, true intellectuals, debating, discussing how to set up a republic that actually works, where there's a balance of powers, where everyone has to abide by the same rules, because they understood that that is the way to create a vibrant, sustainable, long-term project. And it worked for 200 years. In the 20th century, it started going downhill a little bit. And now the current Trump administration using Signal is basically the end of that project. It has now gone into a direction that is no longer consistent with the dream that the founding fathers had. If I were an American citizen, if I were living in the United States and I had some emotional connection to US well-being, I would be crying myself to bed. This is the end of 250 years of US development.
This seems like a great moment to end today's conversation on Signalgate. If you have any questions, comments, or you heard a mistake that we've made throughout the episode, please make sure to send us an email to thewesternbubble@gmail.com, and we will try to incorporate them into our following episodes. Thank you very much to the listeners for joining us today. Make sure to join us again next week when we burst the Western bubble. That is it from my side. Balder, which closing quote did you pick for us today?
Today I've got a very short quote by the great George Bernard Shaw, who said, "Beware of false knowledge. It is more dangerous than ignorance."